Hi, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Over the past few years, the world has come to recognize Abbott as a company dedicated to helping people live happier and healthier lives. In this podcast series, we'll talk with the healthcare leaders, the executives, and the engineers who are working every day to develop new technologies to help people live their best lives. I know you'll enjoy this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Abbott Talks podcast. It's great to have you here. We'll be talking about diabetes in this episode. I had the great fortune of talking with Dr. Mahmoud Kazemi. He is the chief medical officer at Abbott's diabetes care business. And I don't think there's a sector or especially within medtech or within healthcare that's really undergone the transformation that diabetes has undergone over the just the past 4 or 5 years. Not only great technologies like Abbott's FreeStyle Libre, but also the advent of GLP-1 receptor agonists. So we'll talk about that, about all the new dynamics of the diabetes field and also where things are going. Dr. Kazemi shared a little details on new measures that Abbott is working on that could provide even better information to help people with diabetes manage their disease. So it's a very hopeful conversation, I thought, and a great insight not only on diabetes, but on Dr. Kazemi's career. Started off in medicine, moved into industry. That's always an interesting transition and one he was upfront and honest about. So I appreciated that conversation. But before we begin this episode of Abbott Talks, let's bring in our sponsor, BMP Medical. I'm speaking with John Faulkner. John is Vice President of Sales and Marketing at BMP Medical. John, tell us about BMP Medical.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. BMP Medical is a third generation medical plastics manufacturer, and we're located in Sterling, Mass. We have over 45 years of experience, and we pride ourselves on offering a flexible approach to our customers' projects. Each project that we're awarded is tailored to meet our customers' specific needs. As we all know, no one project is ever the same, so it makes it fun and interesting. We have an 80,000 square foot facility, which is 100% focused on medical and diagnostic innovations. We offer injection molding and injection blow molding, which is nicely complemented by a wide range of different capabilities. To name a few of those, we do all of our own manufacturing in a Class 8 cleanroom. We offer product design and development, R&D tooling, custom cleanroom assembly, and Class 7 assembly as well. BMP is ISO 13485 certified. We're also registered with the FDA. And we are a privately held company, and I say that just because we can pivot quickly to address any challenges a project might have. Our customers will always have an experience of a one-on-one personal touch with a complete team approach when interacting with the team here at BMP Medical.
All right, we'll bring John Faulkner back a little later in the podcast, but I'm sure you want more information about BMP Medical right now. Go to its website, B as in boy, M as in man, P as in people, bmpmedical.com. All right, let's get this episode of Abbott Talks underway. Well, Mahmoud Kazemi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Eager to learn more about your work at Abbott Diabetes, but wanted to first hear a bit about your journey that led you there. You've got a very interesting background I'd like to explore. What led you into medicine, first of all?
So I did my training a number of years ago, and what really motivated me to enter medical training in particular was the ability to touch the lives of people on a scale that's, you know, not possible with many other professions. You get to know your patients at a quite personal level and offer them a customized treatment regimen depending on what each of their own needs are. And that really appealed to me, that person-to-person contact and being able to actually provide solutions that are individualized for each patient.
And was there any family connection that drew you into medicine, or just something that was inside of you the whole time?
It was something that was really a strong interest of mine from the very beginning. And I would say that I wasn't quite sure whether I wanted to go into medicine or medical research. And I actually tried both before I made the choice of going into clinical practice. And yeah, that was really sort of the main point for me, was whether I wanted to be able to touch people's lives through the research I do or through providing individual care. And it became clear to me through that process that, you know, individual care is what really was most appealing to me.
Interesting. And I see you were at UCSF, you were a fellow in diabetes and endocrinology and metabolism in July 2002 to 2006. Was that an intentional focus of yours? Has this been a space that's always held your interest?
Yes. So for me, when I was in my general medical training, we were exposed obviously to various disciplines, and endocrinology in particular, which is the study of hormonal disorders, which is where diabetes is, because it is at its base a hormonal disorder, is a discipline that very much appealed to me for a variety of reasons. But I'd say the major thing is that scientifically, you can actually explain to someone who is experiencing a hormonal disorder exactly what is happening in their bodies, and be able to have them understand at a relatively deep level, even if they have no particular scientific training, what exactly is going on and how the treatment you're offering would help. And that for me was very appealing, because people could actually not just take a medication, but actually understand what it was doing inside of them. And that was one of the main reasons I actually went into endocrinology, along with the fact that the actual science behind it was fascinating for me.
That's interesting. It hadn't really occurred to me. So I imagine it's just the ability to really connect with your patient, to provide them a solution to a problem that they're having. And it must be very gratifying to be able to do that.
Absolutely. You know, with a lot of other medical disciplines, we can't offer that level of detail because we don't actually yet know all the details. But endocrinology is quite distinct from that perspective. And that is one of its very appealing features.
Fascinating. So in 2013, you made the move to medical director at Sanofi. What was it about the move to pharma that was appealing? And what was that transition like for you? Was it difficult to leave medicine full time? And perhaps you haven't left it. Maybe you're still practicing. Please tell me if you are.
No, I'm actually not practicing currently. And to answer the question about the transition, it's sort of interesting, because when I did my training, we certainly in medical training get a lot of exposure to academics. And I did do research when I was in my medical training, so I had a good sense of that world. And then I entered the world of clinical practice, which is quite different and which I had experienced for a number of years. And then the world of industry was something that was actually quite foreign to me. And I was recruited into the space by a specific team that really believed that I could do a good job in that world. And it was one of those things where you have to take a blind leap of faith and say, let me give this a try. The reason I did do it is because I knew that by entering into industry, I could actually have the ability to impact thousands of lives. You know, in clinical practice, you certainly have the ability to make a huge impact on a specific number of people who are in your clinical practice. But when you enter industry, you may not know all the individuals you impact on an individual basis, but you know that you will have a very significant impact on a population basis for people around the world when you bring new medications, new technologies to them. And that was what was really appealing for me in terms of why I entered industry. The transition, like to the point you mentioned, it's not something you're trained in medical training for. So again, I was quite fortunate. You know, they say that about life in general. It's just sort of a matter of where you are and when you're there and who you're with, right, in terms of how you end up. So I was very fortunate to have the benefit of really a group of people who were very much invested in making sure I was successful in industry and having the appropriate training for that. And that is exactly how I was able to begin in that career and have thrived in that sense.
What would be some of the advice that you'd share with a colleague who is making that move or has made that move?
It's actually a great question, because I get asked that a lot now by practicing clinicians who are very much interested in coming into industry. And what I would say is, if you go through our classic US medical training and you want to enter in an industry role, you have to be prepared to completely change your mindset, in that you need to understand that you are a member of a larger team that has various stakeholders in it, which in medicine, yes, we have teams, but everyone is medical in some way. When you enter industry, you may be the only medical stakeholder. there are people that have many other perspectives and interests that come to the table. And for, I think, most clinicians, that's a very foreign world because we're not used to a corporate environment from that perspective.
So I could see that being both empowering and also a little scary.
I'll be honest. I mean, many of us, right, when we go through medical training, we are essentially taught to feel that we have a very important opinion and one that should be respected, as well as that of our colleagues. And that is true when you come to industry as well. You do have a very important opinion and one that is respected. But guess what? So do many of the other people around the table. They also have very important opinions and need to be respected. And that's, I think, where it can be challenging for clinicians who enter into industry the first time, is to really understand that and be able to not only become comfortable with it, but to thrive in that environment of varying perspectives and diversity of opinion, and being able to not only learn, but also offer and grow as a result of that.
Forgive me if this is too personal a question, but do you still feel it? You are a physician, you're a doctor, but is that still a part of your primary identity? Is that how you see yourself?
So, Tom, are you asking me if I'm still a real doctor? No, I get that a lot, actually. Or when people say, when you were a real doctor, that's a fun introduction as well. So, yeah, I'm actually still a licensed physician in the U.S., and I do identify first and foremost as a clinician in the context of the reason the work that I do at Abbott and my work in industry still is committed to improving the health of people, right? And as clinicians, that's what we are trained to do. We want to improve health. And when I was practicing in my own office, I was providing that improvement on an individual scale. And now at Abbott, I'm able to impact, as I mentioned, thousands, if not tens of thousands of lives at once when we have, for example, a new technology that comes to market or a new reimbursement win for people living with diabetes in various countries. So yes, I'm still the same person that went into medicine in terms of my commitment to improving the health of others. It's just I'm offering my skills up in a different way.
Absolutely. No, that's great. So I'm just final question about your career. The move from pharma to devices, from Sanofi to Abbott, what can we draw from that? Did you view them as a different opportunity than pharma?
They're quite distinct, actually, not only just in the way that they are regulated and the way that products are brought to market from an industry perspective, but also in what are the most salient aspects for a user, right? For example, when you think of a medication, as a patient, the main things that come to mind when you discuss medications are, what are the dosing, the side effects, what should I be looking for, how long will I need to be on this medication? Those types of questions, which are all very valid, right? What could it possibly interact with? What do I need to be aware of? When we talk about devices and technology, the questions that come to mind are, to a certain extent, quite different. So those are, you know, to the effect of, how will this technology help me? How do I use it in combination with my medical regimen? What is the proper use and what are the different types of data that I could get from this device? So those are very different types of questions than what we generally think of with medications. But I think the underlying similarity here is that both devices and medications are there to help improve the overall health of those people who use them.
Well, let's talk a bit about diabetes itself. Can you give us, this is a topic we hit upon frequently, but I always just like to kind of give a primer in every episode. For those who don't listen to every episode of the podcast, every episode we put out, can you give us just a sort of definitions of type 1 and type 2 diabetes and their prevalence?
Sure. So diabetes, first of all, overall, is a very common condition worldwide. About 540 million people live with diabetes worldwide. And when we look at the numbers for the U.S., that's about slightly over 38 million people live with diabetes. And if you do the math, that's about 11% of the U.S. population. And when you look at sort of the types of diabetes, as you mentioned, let's first sort of define those. The two types that we discuss are type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So what are the differences? Type 1 diabetes might be what some of your listeners have heard traditionally referred to as juvenile or early onset diabetes. We tend not to use those terms anymore because we know that this type of diabetes can occur at various points in someone's lifetime. It's not just in their younger years. So we refer to it as type 1. And this particular type of diabetes is related to an autoimmune condition. So to put that in much more simple terms, what that basically means is that the body no longer produces insulin, which is this hormone that is very critical for taking glucose, or sugar, if you will, as colloquially referred to, but we call it glucose, out of the bloodstream and into the cells, which is where it's used for energy. So insulin is an essential hormone for that process to occur, to get the glucose out of the blood and into the cells. And in people with type 1, their immune systems have attacked the cells that produce insulin in the body. And as a result of that, they're unable to produce any insulin on their own. And so for these individuals, it's absolutely required that they have insulin therapy, depending on which stage they are in the process of type 1 diabetes. But that is the general requirement for their treatment regimens. Now, type 2 diabetes is much more common when you look at numbers. It is approximately 90% of all diabetes is type 2. And about 10% is about type 1 when we look worldwide. In the U.S., the numbers are even greater. 95% is type 2 and about 5% is type 1 when you look at number-wise. So what is type 2 diabetes? Well, type 2 diabetes is essentially not when you don't make any more insulin, but you don't make enough for you. So to explain that, diabetes overall, if you think of it, is essentially a deficiency of insulin. In type 1, it's an absolute deficiency. In other words, the body is not producing insulin at all. So you must take it in order to be able to have some. In type 2, it's a relative deficiency. The body still makes insulin, but it's not enough for that person's needs. And as a result, the treatment regimens that we use for type 2 diabetes can include insulin, but it can also include medications that are not insulin. It can be oral medications. It can be injectables that are not insulin. And the reasons for those is that we actually are helping to improve the body's sensitivity to insulin in many cases for type 2. And type 2 is the type of diabetes that is often associated with having a level of visceral adiposity and having a higher body mass index and these types of, you know, associated with overweight and obesity. And as a result of that, as we know, we have certainly very high rates of that in many countries, including the US. And that is one of the reasons why type 2 has become so prevalent in many countries.
Fascinating. Well, that's a great breakdown. So how do you and how does Abbott view the two types of diabetes? I guess more broadly, type 2, and you've given a great description of it and the cause of it. But I think there's a public perception out there that it's something that maybe doesn't require medical intervention, or at least it's obviously it is not as serious as type 1. How do you view the view of type 2 diabetes by society? Is it something that's, is it an accurate perception, or is it something that needs to be worked on?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because oftentimes when I was in clinical practice, I would have people come to me who were living with type 2 diabetes and who would basically come in with the mentality of, well, this is all my fault. I'm to blame. I basically didn't follow through on what I should have done in terms of activity or diet, and I haven't been able to lose weight. And therefore, this diabetes that I have, it's my own fault. And this, unfortunately, is a very common perception, not only by people living with diabetes, but also by the people who surround them, who are very often well-intentioned, but who may not quite understand the actual pathophysiology behind diabetes. So if you just take a moment, Tom, and think about it, we, I'm sure, know, you know, you, me, many other people, a lot of your listeners, know people who may be overweight or obese who don't suffer from diabetes. And we also know people who perhaps are what appear to us to be at a normal body weight and who do have diabetes. And so that by itself should be, you know, clear enough that diabetes is not just something that is related to weight. There are numerous factors that go into the equation. And those include, for example, age, ethnicity, genetics. Weight can be one of them, but certainly there are many other factors that determine whether someone eventually develops diabetes or not. So the point there is that no one should have stigma around their diabetes diagnosis. Whether they're living with type 1, type 2, or another form of diabetes, diabetes is a medical condition just like any other. It can affect some people, and the people that it affects, it's not their fault that they have it. It is simply a consequence of multiple factors that have brought them to that point. And I think that is one of the key things I'd like for people to take away from this, is that diabetes is a medical condition like any other, and there should be no stigma or blame or fault associated with it. And on top of that, the type 2 diagnosis that you mentioned, another common misperception is that somehow it's not as serious as type 1, which occurs in your younger years in many cases. And that is also quite false, because we know that the complications from diabetes, which can include things like impaired vision, it can include kidney disease, it could include nerve damage, these complications are all related to having chronically high glucose levels. So as you just heard from what I said there, it's not related to your type of diabetes. It's related to the fact that you have diabetes at all, and that you have high glucose levels as a result of that, that are not being managed. So whether that's type 1 or type 2, you can develop complications from diabetes if you don't manage either condition as well as you would want to. And so therefore, it does not somehow diminish the importance of managing type 2 diabetes, because people with type 2 diabetes can develop complications just as can people with type 1 diabetes. So it's a very important condition to be aware of and to manage properly.
All right, we'll take a break from this conversation to bring back our sponsor, BMP Medical. Once again, I'm here with John Faulkner. John is Vice President of Sales and Marketing at BMP Medical. John, how does BMP Medical work with medical device companies?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So we have an acronym here at BMP we like to use, which is CTC. So this stands for Collaboration, Transparency, and Communication. We have to collaborate with our customers on all aspects of their projects to make sure that their priorities are met. This starts right away after an NDA is signed. This is where I like to get myself involved and some other teammates. We like to meet and get a full scope of the project and understand where BMP can fit into the picture and how to solve the problems the customer is having. Understanding our role and what's expected of us greatly accelerates how quickly we can begin working with our customer. We pride ourselves on transparency here and being able to tell a potential customer that their specific project just might not be the right fit for us, or if there are delays in an ongoing project, getting ahead of those and making customers aware of the struggles as early as possible. This ties into the last piece, which is communication. We have to have an open dialogue, not only with our customers, but with our teams here at BMP. This ensures that a project is being taken from quote through to production, paying attention to all of the customer's specifications and regulations along the way. We like saying that working with BMP, you get a tier one manufacturing experience, but with a small family business feel.
That's interesting, John. And do you have any new services or news you want to share with our listeners?
Yes, thank you so much. Like a lot of CMOs, we're investing heavily in new technologies as they come out. You know, we have a lot of end of arm tools and takeoff equipment on pretty much every single machine we have here in the building. But one newer innovation that we're working with here is vision systems. And we can now place a vision system on a machine and capture an amazing amount of detail. And this helps us produce a more consistent and quality part. Just for example, we produce in the neighborhood of 600 million caps in various sizes and various colors. And these new cameras can pick up the color, and along with having a color feeder on each machine, we can make sure that we're providing the exact tone of each cap from each machine more consistently than we ever have before. And this is just one example of how we utilize these systems. We can also detect short shots and other defects that can, at those large numbers of production, bog down anybody's quality department. So it just gets us to produce a more robust and quality part for our customers. But at the end of the day, of course, we want to produce a good part for our customers, but these are going to touch the lives of patients. It's going to affect them. And that's what we really try to keep in the forefront of our minds.
Finally, John, let's look into the crystal ball. How do you see the industry changing in the future?
Thank you. Yeah, I think that this is a tough question. You know, there are so many different factors that could play into the future change of the industry. For example, I think that the government side of things is interesting. It's going to be difficult to gauge what will happen with the R&D tax credit and medical device tax bill, and that could greatly affect how customers bring products to life. So this will be interesting to see these things play out in an election year. For BMP, we're focusing on the people we have in this building and creating the best team and capabilities around that team we can to help customers old and new. We've made significant investments and will continue to invest in our staff and our facility to be a player in this game, regardless of how the industry changes.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, John.
Thank you so much, Tom, for the opportunity to discuss the value BMP can bring to potential customers and patients alike.
Once again, if you'd like more information about BMP Medical, go to its website, bmpmedical.com. Are type 1 and type 2 diabetes the variations of the same disease or two very different diseases?
So the pathophysiology, in other words, how you get to the end result of having diabetes, are quite distinct between the two, I would say. Because as I mentioned, in type 1, it is really an autoimmune process that's at work. And in type 2, we don't feel that that is the case. However, once you get to diabetes and having high glucose levels, the importance of managing those glucose levels to maintain a normal range to help avoid complications is very common to both processes.
Interesting. So let's talk about the past 10 years since, so close to 10 years since you've joined Abbott. What has the treatment options available to, well, we can talk about it broadly as type 1 and type 2, or we can take them separately. How have the treatment options and the products available to the public and those produced by Abbott, how has that changed over the last 10 years? It's felt like there's been a great deal of progress.
Yes, I would agree with you there. I mean, certainly we can talk about it from both, as you had sort of initially discussed, the medication as well as the device standpoint, because there have been progress, really significant progress in both fields. When it comes to medications, we have certainly a variety of different insulins now that are available, even compared to when I did my training, that have various durations of action, various more flexible options for people living with diabetes who need insulin therapy, because, you know, it could be that they need to time it more closely to their meal intake. It may be that they need different versions of insulin to provide them with a much more steady release formulation. And these are now available for people who do need insulin. Now, outside of insulin, we also have had development of new medications, both oral and injectable, that have really revolutionized diabetes management, in particular in the type 2 space. And these include medications that now not only help control glucose levels, but actually help reduce the risk for such important complications as cardiovascular disease, which we know is a significant complication of having diabetes. So it's really great to see these new medications come on market that not only help control glucose, but also actually help reduce the risk of various cardiovascular complications or kidney complications as well. And that has been, I think, a great advance in terms of our medication options. And of course, needless to say, as we've all, I think, have become quite familiar with over the past year, medications like Ozempic and others that are what we call GLP-1 receptor agonists that are often, you know, targeted toward weight loss, but which were originally developed for diabetes management, have really revolutionized the field of type 2 management, because these medications now offer ways to help control glucose levels while also helping individuals reduce weight, which was not something that we were able to really offer people 10 years ago, to your point. We didn't have a lot of options that did that. So this has been really an important advance when it comes to medications. On the technology side, I would add that 10 years ago when I joined Abbott, the predominant way of people basically keeping track of their glucose levels was through something called blood glucose monitoring, which, you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with. This is basically when people take literally a small form of a needle, prick their fingertip with it, and then provide a drop of blood on a glucose test strip that goes into a machine that then measures their levels. And that is what we were asking people with diabetes, whether it was type 1 or type 2, to do. In the case of type 1, sometimes you were asking people to do this 8 to 10 times a day, to literally prick themselves, get a blood sample, and to basically be able to test it to find out. Now, 10 years later, what we've been able to do with our Freestyle Libre systems at Abbott is we have been able to now offer continuous glucose monitoring, which is the use of a sensor with a very small filament that someone basically places on their own skin, and which lasts, in the US, we have versions now that last for up to 15 days. And these sensors essentially are continuously measuring glucose levels and reporting them minute by minute to the user. And this has really revolutionized what kind of data are available to people, so that they now know, for example, not only how their medications are working, but the impact of various daily choices they have to make, as far as food intake, as far as activity goes. In the past, it was like asking someone to drive a car and telling them, you know what, you really should drive in this sort of a speed range, but I can't really tell you what your current speed is at any given time. So imagine driving a car without a speedometer, essentially. You have to go by feel as to whether you were in the right speed range or not. Now with CGM or continuous glucose monitoring, we're able to offer actual clear glucose data to more than 5.5 million people in over 60 countries around the world. And that has been, I think, a huge advance for our space and what Abbott has been able to provide over the past 10 years.
Well, you mentioned the GLP-1 agonists. What impact has that had on the demand for Abbott devices that were being used or are still being used by type 2? Are they as necessary as they were?
And no worries. Yeah. So I'd say actually, this is a question that we were getting a lot last year. Interestingly enough, a lot from the investor community as well, Digitals. And we've actually looked at real world data that we have access to. Again, we are the number one CGM in the world. So we actually have the largest user database, not only in the US, but worldwide, that we can analyze to actually find out what are the patterns of use, in particular, for example, with GLP-1 receptor agonists. And what we've been able to show, actually, is that CGM is a necessary complement for GLP-1 use. And what do I mean by that? When you actually are taking these medications and you're using CGM along with them, you're getting better glycemic outcomes, better overall health outcomes through the use of the two in combination. And we think the reason for that is that they are actually offering the user two different perspectives. The medication is doing what it needs to do in terms of altering food intake and actually improving insulin sensitivity. But the CGM, the continuous glucose monitor, is actually showing the user the impact that the medication is having and allowing them to then, as their bodies get used to the medication, understand when they begin to start taking in more food, which food choices are better for them, which activity choices are better for them. The CGM is, back to my original point, allowing them to customize, individualize their treatment regimen. And that's why people who are using the medications in combination with CGM seem to have much better outcomes compared to those who are using the medications alone.
Interesting. Is there an opportunity for CGMs to be used by folks who don't have any form of diabetes, but are just hungry for data about their body's performance?
So there have actually been some recent articles you probably have seen in the news and elsewhere about the use of CGM in populations without diabetes. And certainly Abbott does have a arm of the business that is looking at that population. But my area of expertise and what, you know, my focus on is for people living with diabetes and how we can use these technologies. But certainly that is an interesting area that, again, Abbott is also exploring.
Terrific. Let's talk about type 1. What are the opportunities for folks with type 1 diabetes?
So for GLP-1 receptor agonists and type 1 diabetes, we actually at this point in time don't have the approvals for that in the US for use in type 1 particularly. But what I would say is CGM, certainly it has revolutionized the landscape of type 1. And what I think it really has done is has really helped not only people living with type 1 have a much better way of making sure they don't go into the high and lows that they often experience as a result of fluctuations in their glucose levels, but also allows them to be able to access technologies such as integrated insulin pump devices, connected pens. And that's really where our commitment has been for the type 1 space is not only did we help bring CGM to more people living with type 1 worldwide, but we are now a partner of choice for integrations. We have had integrations in the US, for example, with the Tandem insulin pump system and in Europe with the Ypsomed insulin pump system. So we are bringing more and more of these integrations, including integrations with Insulet soon to be available. And so what this allows people with type 1 is the ability to actually have a system where not only are they sensing the glucose with their Abbott Freestyle Libre sensor, but also at being able to make appropriate insulin dosing decisions through integration with a pump or a pen delivery method for their insulin. And so that really has been the important change that we've seen in the type 1 space is that we are not only offering the data, but we're also offering the appropriate insulin solution for those individuals.
Where is this taking us? What with the technology that's been developed, that's been released, the partnerships between the various companies that you mentioned, which is, I think, an interesting dynamic in a great intersection for diabetics to have these companies providing products that can deliver what they do. Where are we headed with this technology and with the GLP-1s? What is your outlook for folks with type 1 or type 2 diabetes in the coming years?
So I'd say, you know, one of the most important new developments that Abbott's bringing to the market in type 1 in particular, but I can also see where this would also be very helpful in certain situations with type 2, is the development of a continuous ketone sensor. So we've been talking a lot about continuous glucose monitoring, which is, again, looking at the levels of glucose in the interstitial fluid, which is the fluid that's in between the cells. But Abbott is a pioneer in bringing a technology called continuous ketone monitoring. And what are ketones? So ketones are basically another form of fuel outside of glucose that the body produces in certain situations when it feels that there is not enough glucose available. And the issue with ketones is that in type 1 in particular, they are produced when in general the body feels that there's not, it can't sense insulin available at all. And so it's essentially producing ketones in an effort to help nourish the body without insulin being present. And it's therefore, as you could imagine, as I mentioned up front, type 1 is a situation where the body doesn't produce insulin to begin with. It's usually a marker that there is something significant going on in terms of imminent compromise for that individual with type 1 diabetes. So it's very important to be able to sense the presence of ketones very early on in order to address the underlying issue, whether that could be another health condition that's exacerbating the glycemic control, or whether it is because the person is not getting enough insulin through their insulin pump or other delivery method. It is important to be able to detect that and to address it. And right now, our methodology for detecting ketones is through, again, test strips, which is the same place we were 10 years ago with glucose, is where we are currently with ketones. And what Abbott is doing is bringing a continuous ketone sensor that would be a dual analyte sensor. In other words, the person would place a sensor on their skin, and it would be able, the same one sensor would be able to measure both glucose and ketone. And we're really the only company that is pioneering this technology at this point. And this would be in our Freestyle Libre 3 footprint, which is the smallest and thinnest, most discreet sensor that would be available on the market. So it's quite remarkable with such a small footprint that it can measure both analytes, glucose and ketone. And what we've shown at scientific congresses just earlier this year is that in people with type 1 diabetes, that they will be able to detect the presence of ketones up to, you know, many hours earlier than what would be available through their glucose levels. So most of the time, people are taught with type 1 diabetes, wait and see if your glucose levels are rising, then check ketones. And what we're showing now is no, you should actually be monitoring for ketones and glucose concurrently, because the ketone level begins to rise hours before the glucose level does. And by giving yourself that head start of knowing that the ketone levels are on the rise, you can more successfully address the underlying issue and avoid ending up in the emergency department, in the hospital, for example. And that is really what's going to be a huge game changer in the type 1 space. In the type 2 space, I would say that the concurrent use of CGM with such technologies as GLP-1s, and also more and more we're seeing payers, both private and public payers, understanding that people not only with type 1 need CGM, but people with type 2, whether they're using insulin or not, can benefit from these technologies. And we have done, again, studies, real-world studies and other clinical studies that are underway that have shown the benefits of using continuous glucose monitoring in people, for example, who are living with diabetes but who are not using insulin. So you might wonder, well, why would those people benefit from this? This is getting to your earlier question around, can it even help people without diabetes? Well, again, coming back to diabetes, we do know that people with diabetes are still making decisions around food choices, activity choices. They have to make multiple decisions like that every day. And what CGM does is it empowers them. It gives them the information they need to be able to understand the individual impact of various foods and activities. And that's where the beauty of CGM lies. It gives that information is power. And that cannot be underestimated in a chronic disease condition like diabetes, where many people feel hopeless. They feel that this is something that's happening to them and they have no control over it. And what you do when you give someone CGM, when you put that Abbott Freestyle Libre sensor on, is for the first time, they actually see the reality of what's going on and how the different decisions that they're making impact their glucose. And they feel for the first time that they have the power to make a decision that will actually help keep their glucose in the range that they want it to be in. And that is a really beautiful thing, is all I've got to say, because especially when you've worked with people living with diabetes as long as I have, you see the hopelessness that sinks in. And when you see the sort of light that comes with having this information in your fingertips and being able to actually use it in a way that makes you feel good about yourself and what you're doing. And that really is very gratifying for us, all of us that work at Abbott, I would say.
Help me understand the actual real-world impact that CGMs and insulin pumps have had on folks 10 years ago or prior to this technology. How frequently might someone go to an ER? How frequently might someone have a truly debilitating attack and how does that compare to today?
So we've actually done analyses of our databases, both again in the US and outside the US. And what we've seen consistently is that people who use CGM, whether they have type 1, whether they have type 2, have less visits to the emergency department. They have less ambulance call outs. They have basically a much lower overall cost of healthcare. And when you look at the number of people affected by diabetes and all the complications that can be associated with it, reduction of even a small amount in the amount of expenditure makes a huge impact when you take it from the individual to the population. And that is really a benefit, again, of people having data, having information that helps them make much more educated choices when it comes to various aspects of their lifestyle. And that is really the fundamental aspect of liberation that Libre's name is even based on, right? We are helping by providing this technology liberate people from many of the burdensome aspects of diabetes management, of not knowing. And we're offering them really with not only information, but solutions of how to use that information to make better choices, whether that be around better choices about insulin dosing, better choices about food intake, better choices about knowing that your ketone levels are on the rise. We're all about empowering people living with diabetes to have their fullest lives. And that's what makes me proud to be a part of Abbott every day.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a really informative and wonderful overview, and I'm really grateful for the time you took. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks again to BMP Medical for sponsoring this episode of Abbott Talks. Thanks, of course, to Dr. Mahmood Kazemi for being our guest and to you for being our listeners. If you wouldn't mind subscribing to our Device Talks podcast network, really appreciate it. We would not only send you future episodes of Abbott Talks directly to your phone or listening device, but you'll receive our other great podcasts as well, including Device Talks Weekly. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, on YouTube. So please make sure you're keeping track of what we're putting out on Device Talks. Please connect with me on LinkedIn as well. My name is Tom Salemi. I'm editorial director of Device Talks. Tom, Salemi. And finally, if you wouldn't mind giving us a ranking of this podcast, I don't ask that frequently, but it's my understanding it really does help spread the word about these podcasts. So if you have a moment and you have an opinion and you'd like to share, please give us, I hope, a positive ranking on your favorite podcast player. All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks again for being part of this episode of Abbott Talks. We're already working on our next one. We'll have that coming to you very soon. Take care, everybody.